Hello and welcome to our CrossCast webinar series. My name is Katie Turner and I'm the Education and Events Coordinator here at Cross Financial. Today's topic is Can Medicaid Take Your Client's House? Guest hosted by Zach Blackham, Learning Faculty of Wealth Council. First, we have a few housekeeping items. If you have any questions during today's webinar, go ahead and type those in the questions section of the GoToWebinar toolbar so we can answer them at the end of the presentation. Next, a copy of today's PowerPoint can be found in the handout section of the GoToWebinar toolbar. We also ask that you please complete the post-webinar survey that will pop up on your screens at the end of the presentation, as this is a requirement for CLE purposes to receive your certificate of attendance. And now, let's get to today's presentation. Zach, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the invitation. Thanks for everyone for joining me today. We're going to talk about Medicaid and estate recovery. So just with any other presentation, any of the materials that I provided or anything that I talk about is intended to be not relied on as legal advice. I'm an attorney, but I'm not licensed in all 50 states. So take this as information and do your own research. So the agenda for today is as follows. It's important that we kind of mention the concept of Medicaid means is a big old topic, and it's a complex one. And we're not going to be discussing subrogation or personal injury settlements. So as hopefully it was described in the registration, this is focused on liens and recovery as it relates to long-term care, Medicaid, and the primary residence. So we're going to start by discussing the Medicaid rules generally. We'll move to talking about Medicaid in the home. And then we'll go to the two different sections of liens that we'll talk about, lifetime liens and post-death liens, and then potential strategies that we might be able to implement to ensure good outcomes for our clients. So as you know, Medicaid is a joint and federal and state health insurance program with different offerings covering the full spectrum of healthcare needs. Lots of different types of Medicaid programs, lots of different, even in the same state, you may have different eligibility requirements within the same program. I travel around and teach on Medicaid issues throughout the country, and so It's always fascinating to talk with individuals in one state about what planning techniques or planning strategies or how their Medicaid office treats certain things in one instance. Talk to someone else at the same dinner table from a different state and they do something totally different. Medicaid's massive and complex. There's a, if you remember Judge Friendly, remember Judge Friendly from law school? He said, a famous jurist, if you don't know who he was, he said, quote, as program and program of Medicaid have evolved, there has developed a degree of complexity, and particularly in the regulations, which makes them almost unintelligible to the uninitiated. So if that's how Judge Friendly looked at the Medicaid rules and the Medicaid regulations back in 1976, you could imagine how much more they are unintelligible for most of the clients that you interact with and attorneys too. As I mentioned, each state has unique programs and rules and regulations. So the general rules are common among and across state lines, but planning strategies may work well in Montana that don't work well in Maine or Missouri. Because Medicaid is a health insurance program and it's means tested, at least referring to the nursing home program, beneficiaries must or applicants must meet certain criteria to be able to qualify. And so I've broken those down into four different sections: the medical test, the income test, the asset test, and the transfer test. Now, the medical test, if we're speaking to long-term care, it's typically an institutionalization. This is state by state, has different documents you have to fill out and things you have to move forward with. But the medical test simply will mean that you need the assistance of two people. Usually a two-person assist is a nice shorthand for qualifying for the medical test. The income test, because it's means tested and because the long-term care programs require a share of cost, the client is going to be paying all but a few little dollars of their income towards their share of cost. There's always something that when you're talking to clients about Medicaid, that you can always give them some information because they may be misunderstanding the differences and distinctions between Medicare and Medicaid. Thankfully, the government decided to name them something so similar that they sometimes are treated as one and the same. And your clients, if they've been familiar with Medicare over the course of their life, since their retirement age, may think that things are similar on the Medicaid side. And those of us in the industry know that that's not the case. Because it's a means-tested program, there's a certain asset test or a resource limit that individuals and spouses must maintain to ensure Medicaid eligibility. And buttressing that asset test is the transfer test, which federal rules prohibit any asset transfers for less than fair market value within the last 5 years. Again, another thing that some folks will misunderstand is the concept of a transfer or a gift. They think of a gift in full, right? If I have $1,000 and I transfer the $1,000, give it away to my son, then I have a transfer of asset. Well, that's obviously true. But if I own a piece of property and I sell it to give my son a nice discount that's below the fair market value, then I have gifted assets between what I sold it for and what the fair market value is. So it's not an all or nothing with the transfer test. It's not something that clients sometimes have difficulty understanding. So with single individuals and married couples, they're required again to be below that certain asset threshold to be eligible for benefits. And that five-year look back is designed to ensure that improper transfers don't go unpunished, you should say. Concept is that we don't want someone with $1 million on Monday to transfer it to their son on a Tuesday and then qualify for taxpayer benefit programs on a Wednesday. And so the asset test and the transfer test are really one and the same in terms of their end goal. So when referring to that, when someone's striving to get on Medicaid, particularly long-term care Medicaid, one of the benefits that they have is that they want to be able to get on this program without having, you know, their entire life overwhelmed. Medicaid applicants often have as their most important asset is their home. And so the Medicaid rules allow for that primary residence to be exempt for purposes of initial eligibility up to defined equity limits if you're a single individual, for that purposes of that initial qualification. So if an individual declares that they have an intent to return home, then if they are a single individual and they are within that maximum equity cap, which is different state by state, changes yearly from that 713 up to the 1.033 million. If they meet the criteria, then that home can be exempt for that initial eligibility determination. This home equity limit does not apply, however, if the applicant's spouse, minor, or disabled child lives in the home. So I had a couple clients came in when I was in practice, and they would say, well, we read online that, so we Googled, we used the Google lawyer, and our house is worth way too much. There's no way that my husband's going to be able to qualify for Medicaid. Well, they were wrong because the home equity limit does not apply if that applicant's spouse is living in the home. And so no matter what that home value was, if they met all of the criteria, then that would not be a bar to eligibility. And Medicaid gives these certain special treatment to assets, I would say, not because they, you know, have a goodness in their heart. Maybe that's a part of it. But as we're talking about today, it has a lot to do with the ability of the state to be able to recoup from Medicaid applicants and Medicaid recipients at that point the benefits that have been paid out on their behalf. And the intent to return home is the client's subjective one. Obviously, if I have an individual lady and she lives in a house and she transitions to the nursing home and she's, you know, admitted and she has a skilled nursing bed and she's trying to qualify for Medicaid, the chances of her returning home are substantially small. But even if there is really no reasonable chance for her to return home, the home is exempt because they want, the state says, well, if there is a chance for you to return home, we want you to be able to leave the nursing home and go home somewhere if you get better. Now, I did have clients occasionally who would get better and go home. That wasn't the typical route that they would take, but the rules would allow that to be the option if that was the end result. So the home equity limit, as you can see, it's kind of spread out throughout the country where we have rates at 713 is the vast majority of states. A couple of states, including Wisconsin and Idaho and Maine, have that 750 figure, with Colorado and Washington and then some of the northeastern states having the 1.71. Now, the California had recently abolished their asset limit as long as they're home equity. But we don't really talk about California so much in Medicaid planning because we know that the rules there are quite different. So when clients ask about, and they would ask, and they did ask me this question all the time, where they would say, well, can Medicaid take my client's house? And that's why I chose this question as a topic of the presentation, because it's a question that I got nearly every week in my practice. And the answer that I would give is yes, Medicaid can take your house, but maybe not in the way that your clients would imagine. We usually imagined, you know, either the client being required to deed the property to Medicaid on condition of eligibility or being forced to sell a home in order to qualify. That's not how it works. Federal law requires that states recover from the estates of deceased and Medicaid recipients up to the value of taxpayer-funded benefits paid on their behalf. So if an individual goes on Medicaid benefits and they have a home, the state has a right, a condition of Medicaid, to recover against the value of that home from the estate of that deceased. Let's assume that that individual is on Medicaid for 1 month, and the total cost of care paid out on that behalf of that individual is $5,000, and that individual passes away. Well, that $5,000 is now going to be something the state can claim against the estate of the deceased. They can't claim more than that. They can only claim what they paid out on behalf of that individual's Medicaid benefits. If the home is sold, there's no home at all, there's nothing in their accounts, it's all gone, then they're not going to be able to satisfy that full claim. And that's the distinction. If for as long as you're on Medicaid, you're going to be, I guess, having your bill is going to be increased about what potentially could be that payback on the backside. But I thought the home was exempt. This is the follow-up question. But you were just telling me, Zach, in our meeting here, that I could have my home exempt, that they weren't going to require me to sell it. And that's true. But an asset like a home, which is exempt for purposes of initial and continuing eligibility, may not be exempt from lien and estate recovery. So you have to think of these things as two different threshold analysis between initial and continuing eligibility and then estate recovery. A lot of times courts, and I would say Medicaid agencies, sometimes conflate those two together, and that's not how the statute's written, that's not how the regulations are written. And we as practitioners and people in this industry have to make sure that we're not allowing Medicaid agencies to dilute that water, to bring those things together, because they're very separate and distinct analysis that we have to make sure that. But what Medicaid's doing is they're saying, we're okay with you on the front end keeping the home, but that doesn't mean that those same exemptions will apply on the backside. Federal law provides a framework for these two types of mechanisms to reimburse taxpayers for benefits, what we call the TEFRA, or the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act of 1982. This is what we refer to as a lifetime lien. The state has a right through a statute to exert recovery against an individual during the life of the Medicaid recipient, not necessarily getting paid, but ensuring future recovery, meaning they could place a lien on the property. Estate recovery, on the other hand, is codified in 42 USC 1396P. This is a death lien. So the state asserts recovery at death of the Medicaid recipients to reimburse for the benefits paid out. States are required to review, or states are required to recover against the Medicaid recipient when they pass away. They are not required to implement TEFRA liens during life. So let's talk about TEFRA liens. Let's start there. The Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act of 1982 authorizes states to impose a lien on a home during the life of the recipient if certain conditions are met. And the federal authority here, with additional regulations at 433.36 of the CFR. They state that if an individual is an inpatient of a medical institution and must, as a condition of receiving services, apply his or her own income to the cost of care, and I referred to that already as part of the income test. We know that as a nursing home Medicaid applicants are required to pay a share of costs, which includes them applying his or her own income to their cost of care. So we know nursing home residents would be within that first bullet point. The state determines that he or she cannot reasonably be expected to be discharged and returned from home. individual has had notice and an opportunity to be heard, and there's no spouse, child under 21, disabled child, or sibling with an equity interest lawfully residing in the home. So what the home, remember, was exempt from initial and continuing eligibility, meaning it didn't count towards the asset limit if the client had an intent to return home, that subjective intent to return home, saying, if I get better, I want to go home. And that's what the client said, I intend to return home. Well, what the state's saying here is, okay, you think you can return home. We've made an objective finding that states that you cannot be reasonably be expected to be returned home. And so you're not going to return home. And the policy solution to that is that we're going to exempt that home from initial eligibility, but we're going to subject it to lien during life and recovery after death. That's where the rubber meets the road in terms of the initial eligibility and the determination that the client's subjective intent is okay to make that asset not countable for initial eligibility. And the state saying, well, objectively, we've made a determination that you're not going to be returning home. Now, this authority, this TEFRA authority, as I mentioned, it's a permissive one. It's not a compulsory one. And states are required to implement recovery at death, but not during life. A great resource to find more specifics on TEFRA as well as the state recovery is to look at your own state's Medicaid plan. So these portions that relate to liens and recovery are in the state Medicaid plan 4.17 and 4.17 attachment A. And in this, the states are required as part of their state plan to define certain terminology and outline certain procedures, how their state's going to handle specific Medicaid policies relating to TEFRA, and if that's something your state does in the state recovery. So there's no requirement for the recipient to sell the house in a TEFRA situation. It's not saying you got to sell it immediately. It's simply noting that if there is a sale, that the state has an interest in the proceeds of that up to the amount of benefits paid. If the individual were to return home, then the statute requires that lien be dissolved. TEFRA can attach to permanently institutionalized individuals of any age. So unlike some of the estate recovery provisions, there is an age bar for TEFRA. If the home is sold during the lifetime of the recipient, then the state can recover up to the amount of benefits paid up to that point of assistance. So if mom's on Medicaid and there's a TEFRA lien that's filed and mom's been in there for a year, mom sells the house, the TEFRA lien will allow them to recover that year of benefits, but that doesn't mean that mom's, done. If she has all these assets, she's now she's not ineligible for Medicaid. She's going to have to requalify in some way. So it's a way for the state to ensure that they aren't left out of the loop in terms of assets that are within the realm of a Medicaid recipient. If it isn't sold, then the lien is recovered after death up to the total amount of the benefits paid. Let's look at one of our examples here. So let's look at Frances. Frances is a single woman and she's a homeowner and she's admitted to a facility. So she goes to the nursing home facility. She was unable to live safely at her home anymore. She comes to you and you help her walk her through that process. And maybe you help with Kraus get her an annuity product of some kind, a Medicaid compliant one. You're able to get her approved for Medicaid. So Frances applies and is approved for Medicaid, thanks to your work. And then a statutory timeline, depending on how your state has decided to write this statute, passes. That can be 90, 120, 180 days, and the state determines that Frances cannot reasonably be expected to return home. So remember, this is that determination that's objective to the state, saying we've made a determination that if you can meet nursing home criteria, obviously, that it doesn't look to us that you're going to be able to return home, because the chances of an institutionalized individual returning home, I would say, are small. And so the state's made that determination, and they send a notice to the client, and they say, we just want to let you know that we have a lien, and that you have an opportunity for Frances to rebut that medical finding and potentially ask for some sort of exemption or deferral. If that is unsuccessful, then the TEFRA lien would be placed on the home. Again, Francis is not required to sell it at this point, regards to TEFRA. It's just to notice that the state has an interest if Francis's home is sold then or in the future. So this is put together a map showing where TEFRA is authorized, and I actually said this to Jim here at Kraus, that sometimes I'm a little hesitant putting maps together because this is what's authorized by the respective authorities within the state, not necessarily whether you're actually doing it. And there's a degree to how aggressive the state may be in imposing TEFRA liens in their programs. And so sometimes some things are not set in stone. For example, Connecticut recently, I believe, eliminated its TEFRA authority. And then you can see here what an example for Massachusetts may look like. So here is one of the real estate lien here, where it talks about that the state, the real estate enables the Mass Health to recover the cost of medical benefits paid on behalf of a member before the death of a member. So this is during the life of the member. The Mass Health agency will place a lien against any property in which the member has a legal interest, subject to the following conditions. And that's the conditions that we talked about, obviously. So there's not someone, so the member is an inpatient receiving long-term or chronic care in a nursing home, and that none of these following things happen. There's not a spouse, a child under 21, or a sibling with an equity interest. You see down there in 2C, the Mass Health agency determines that the member cannot reasonably be expected to be discharged from the medical institution and return home. So there's that diagnosed saying, we just don't think you're going to be able to return home. And then D there, the member has received notice of MassHealth's determination of the above conditions and have met, and that the lien will be placed. The notice includes the member's right to a fair hearing. So you'd be able to get in there and make that determination and potentially argue through the next section there, the exceptions and the deferments, why you might not be subject to these types of liens. And then there in E, it says that the MassHealth agency will discharge a lien placed on the property under this if the member was released from the medical institution and returns home. That's a good encapsulation there in that Massachusetts statute in the CMR there, how they would do this. Now let's look a little bit in practice. So here's a letter that was sent to a client of mine, letting my client know that the state of Utah, where I live, was going to assert a TEFRA lien. So it said, this is preliminary notice of the Office of Recovery Services intent to oppose a TEFRA lien on your real property located at that address. And it gives us a brief summary. The TEFRA lien is a claim on a property of a person for as security for a payment of a just debt authorized by the TEFRA statute. This lien will be, and then you see there, lien was for about $63,000. And then according to the department's records, it talks about here are the reasons why we believe we can do this. You're in an inpatient care facility. You're spending costs for your medical care. We don't believe you can be discharged. And then on that fourth bullet, you can see that the statutory timeline in my state was 180 days immediately preceding the day on which the department provides notice. So this client had been in an inpatient care facility for at least 180 days, and then this was sent. Then it gives the same as in Massachusetts here, but this is kind of a way of showing where a letter will follow what the statute and regulations require, telling my client that here are some things that you can do. If any of these things are a reality in your situation, then you may not be subject to this. Most of the time, what we found is that the state had done its due diligence and would not seek one outside of their purview. That's not always the case, so make sure that you are following up with them on that. But most of the time, if they determined that a TEFRA lien was going to be attachable, then it typically was. Let's assume in this case that my client wasn't able to find any sort of exemption or any sort of deference. Then what we would have is the notice of an actual lien placed on the property. So here it is recorded against the property where it said the undersigned, the Office of Recovery Service was asserting a TEFRA lien against this property at this address on this date and for the sum of that dollar amount that they had currently. Now, that wasn't like that was the only dollar amount that they would be able to get. That's just what they had at the time of the TEFRA lien. Obviously, if my client was continuing to be on Medicaid, then they would have additional dollar figures that they could recover as my client continued to be on Medicaid. Okay, let's move on to post-death liens now. So this is what most folks are aware of, in that the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1993, or OBRA, requires states on condition of Medicaid funding to recover from the estates of deceased Medicaid recipients. As you mentioned before, where we had TEFRA, which is not, it's permissive, it's not compulsory. State recovery is compulsory on condition of Medicaid funding. Some of the states got mad about that. West Virginia said, we don't believe that this requirement for estate recovery was proportionally correlated with the potential loss of our entirety of our Medicaid funds. At that time, I think, from what I remember, the West Virginia was receiving about $1 billion in Medicaid funding, but its estate recovery program was only recovering somewhere, you know, in the millions, in the low millions. And so they argued that this was coercive, that it was a betrayal of the New Deal, and they just flatly refused to implement an estate recovery program. West Virginia mounted a facial challenge in the Fourth Circuit, had some states follow a suit, and they said this was a 10th Amendment coercion, that we should not have all of our Medicaid funds be conditioned on this silly little state recovery program. It's not working. Unfortunately for the state, and fortunately for maybe some of our clients, that failed, and with the court finding that the conditioning of funding was not constitutionally prohibited, and that meant that they were going to be required to institute and continue their program. Now, that was something that not all the states were still okay with. In fact, in Louisiana's enabling statute on this issue of state recovery, it says something to the effect of, paraphrasing here, but it is the policy of Louisiana that we don't believe it's undignified, and it's not the culture and values of Louisiana to recover against indigent people's homes to recover costs of medical care. But we have to do this because we want to be able to have our Medicaid funding, and so we're going to continue to do it. And so you see there that this isn't a program that's without controversy. And in fact, there's some legislation that was put in the House, and it happens quite often, just this last session, that actually posited through a new piece of legislation to repeal estate recovery altogether as being, you know, non-economical and unethical. And we'll see where that goes. But the lay of the land now is that states are required to recover from the estates of deceased Medicaid recipients up to the full cost of benefits paid. Individuals who are 55 in age and older when they received assistance, and generally such assistance consisted of nursing home facilities or home and community-based services or related hospital and drug services. Now, they're required to recover from the estates of deceased Medicaid recipients, but they are given a permissive authority to recover beyond the estate if they so choose. And so constitutionality is no longer the issue. So now it's really how aggressive the states wanted to be in their recovery efforts. Estate, as I'm doing my quotes here, that estate recovery rests on how each state defines the word estate for purposes of recovery. So here's the federal statute itself, 42 U.S.C. 1396b4, and it says that estate shall include all real and personal property and other assets included within the individual's estate as defined for purposes of the state probate law. And so there you can see that compulsory shall language saying that the state shall recover from the individual estate if it's defined in the probate estate. And then there's the permissive may that says that may include, at the option of the state, any real and personal property and other assets in which the individual had any legal title or interest at the time of death, including such assets can stay to a survivor, heir, or a side of the deceased individual through joint tenancy, tenancy in common, survivorship, life estate, living trust, or other arrangement. So it's a very broad category. It's basically like you get the very small estate as defined by probate, or basically anything that the individual had in their name that passed in any way to anybody when they passed it. So you can categorize these states into two different recovery regimes, the first being that limited estate recovery, where the state recovers all real and personal property from the probate estate of the Medicaid recipient. Expanded estate recovery, on the other hand, is that the state recovers all real and personal property from the probate estate and any asset in which the recipient had an interest in at the time of death. So each state, as I mentioned before, and their attachments to that state Medicaid plan are required to define what they mean by estate for purposes of estate recovery. So this isn't always the same definition as estate in the federal statute, and it's not always the same definition of estate as it is in the state code. This definition would be in the state Medicaid plan itself. So each state defines this, what I call the recovery estate. And again, it should not be conflated with the estates as defined in other contexts and regulatory regimes. So if you want to learn more about it, looking at the attachments in your state plan, 4.17A should be a good learning guidance to see where your states are at. I took a few examples to show here. So here's the state plan from Nevada. 4.17A here, and you see the state defines estate as follows. Estate means all real and personal property and other assets included in the estate of the deceased recipient of Medicaid and any other assets in which or to which he or she had an interest or legal title at time of death to the extent of that interest or title. The term includes assets passing by reason of joint tenancy, tenants in common, life estate, survivorship, living trust, annuity, homestead or other arrangements. So you can see there that's different than the federal statute in terms of what that definition was, but this is how they define it. And you already can tell here that this is an expanded recovery jurisdiction in Nevada, right? We have, it's the recipient's deceased, it's the Medicaid recipient's estate and any interest they had at the time of the death, including all of those things in that definition. On the other hand, here is a definition from the state plan in Texas, where it says estate, the real and personal property of a decedent by both as such property originally exists and from time to time, blah, 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 by any accretions and additions and substitutions that is included in the definition of probate estate in a certain section of the Texas probate code. So this is a limited jurisdiction. Texas is a limited jurisdiction. There's language clearly defining explicitly that this is specific to the probate estate in Texas for purposes of recovery. Well, it's important to remain vigilant because on top of we have an expanded recovery state and we have a limited recovery state, here's how they do it in Pennsylvania, where they define estate as all real and personal property and other assets included in the individual's estate as provided in PA law. So you would assume there that that is a limited recovery jurisdiction, right? Well, in the actual statute itself, it's highlighted there, it says with the approval of the governor, so Governor Shapiro decides that he wants to do something different, the department may expand the estate recovery program by regulation to include medical assistance for services other than those listed in this section and to recover against other real and personal property in which the individual had any legal title or interest at the time of death. So now we have a situation where currently the law in Pennsylvania is that it is a limited jurisdiction. And we now have a statute stating that with some triggering language saying that if the governor decides that he or she at that point wants to make a change, then they can expand it through regulation. So it's important to remain vigilant about that because you can see maybe how things could change for your clients from one day to the next. So here's the current view of what is authorized from the state recovery within the state plans themselves. It's interesting to see for many reasons. From my research, sometimes the state's plan says one thing and the statute says another, and practice is one or the other, and it can be difficult to really track down how things are going. Long story short, use this as a guide, and please do your own research. And remember, there's always a lot of shades of gray, particularly in limited recovery jurisdictions. So for example, in Tennessee, it's a limited recovery jurisdiction. Well, there's case law in Tennessee that states, well, if you transfer all of your assets from yourself to your living trust and make your estate insolvent, then of course we're going to be able to recover from your trust. Well, that's no longer a limited recovery jurisdiction, right? That's an expanded recovery jurisdiction by practice. And so it's important just to make sure that you're maintaining exactly what your state's doing and how aggressive that state is in those processes. Illinois, for example, I know I talked to some practitioners about Illinois being aggressive in the TEFRA industry, in the TEFRA world, but not being as aggressive in the estate recovery. And then we have some situations where Colorado, on the other hand, is a limited recovery jurisdiction, and they are extremely, extremely aggressive in how they recover. Minnesota, another one where it's very, very aggressive. Iowa, very aggressive. Where I am from, very aggressive. And that doesn't necessarily connotate or correlate with whether they have a TEFRA plan. So you have to treat these things as separate, because a state may be aggressive in one and may not be aggressive in another. And unfortunately, there are some states out there that are aggressive in both. So let's look at David. David's our second case study. David is a single man, and he's a homeowner, and he's admitted to the facility. David applies, approved for Medicaid. David receives care at the facility for 5 years, and then David passes away. In an expanded jurisdiction, the state's going to send a notice of estate recovery to David's heirs, along with an instruction for applying for deferral or exemption. In a limited recovery jurisdiction, the state's going to send a notice of the estate recovery to the heirs, or they may even just file as a creditor in the probate matter. That, you see that happen sometimes. David's heirs and the estate then pay the balance of the assistance owed to the state. Here's a letter to one of my clients, an estate recovery letter, where it said, the state of Utah is required to recover Medicaid funds. We can't recover it under this statute until after the death of the recipient spouse, and only if there are no minor disabled children. Here's the statutes, here's the citations, and here's the recovery amount. You see there, it's a pretty big number there, $284,754.34. And then my clients would say, this debt must be paid in a timely manner. Please call me at the number listed below within 10 days to discuss this matter. Well, if you want your clients or those to be scared, you can imagine that there really can't be many situations where you can be more spooked than by getting a letter from the IRS saying you owe $284,000, or from the state saying you owe $284,000. Those are pretty much the highest bar in terms of feeling that that emotional taxation. In this case, if this was David and David had no other way of, David's home was still there, then when David's home was sold, then those proceeds would be provided to the state, and they would clear the lien, and if there was anything left, it could go to David's heirs. This is an important point to mention in terms of estate recovery, because you have to ensure that number, that $284,754.34 in this case, are properly calculated. Because this is usually done by a part department that's separate and distinct from the Medicaid eligibility department. And so sometimes those numbers don't quite coincide with each other. I'll give you a couple of examples. I had one client of mine who had a situation quite like this, $284,000. Actually, I think it was more. I think it was in the 350 plus range. And she called me on the phone and she said, Zach, I don't understand this letter. And I'm like, what do you mean? What do you mean? Well, I called Medicaid, right after mom died. And I said, do you have anything owed? Anything? Do we need to be worried about anything coming in the future? We want to make sure we're doing things right. And the Medicaid office told me that they didn't see anything owed and that everything was good. Well, I've sold the house. The house is gone. We've distributed the money, and now I get this letter, 6 months later, what am I going to do? Well, what she didn't know is that she was calling the eligibility determination people and not the estate recovery people. So the eligibility people are going to be like, yeah, it doesn't look like anything's owed because obviously you've been paying your share of cost. And they wouldn't know that there was a bill that was accruing on the estate recovery side, and she had never actually spoken to them. So it may add to a lot of stressors for these individuals because she had already sold the home. It can also add a lot of complexity to the clients if they didn't know this was happening. hopefully the attorney or whomever was walking them through the Medicaid application process would have given them some knowledge that this was happening, but it isn't always the case. If you are an attorney and you're listening to this, please talk to your clients about estate recovery when you're doing eligibility determinations and you're helping them with that, because they will thank you later. And if you don't do it, they're going to think it's your fault when they come back and see this big old $284,000 bill due. There was a client that came in that had gotten Medicaid before we ever got involved. And she said, yeah, mom's house is worth $250,000. This little one, we kept it for mom for the past 4 years. We just, you know, we could have sold it lots of times before that, but we just wanted to keep it for her, just in case she could come home. But we just sold it for $250,000. And there was four kids. And so we want to be able to get rid of, you know, to sell the home and distribute it. Well, they got a letter that said they owed $250,000, and they sold the home for that. And so where did all the money go? The money all went to the state and not to these sisters who had kept mom's home up to snuff for the past 4 or 5 years. So it was pretty unjust for them, because obviously if they would have sold the home, maybe we could have done some planning that could have potentially allowed them to get some use out of that through funeral plans or whatever it may have been. But in the end, the money went to the state. Final tip I'll give if you're dealing with estate recovery, again, is to make sure they're calculating these things properly. So I got a letter saying, yeah, your client owes $300,000, and we're not going to fight it if they truly owe it, right? That's a requirement of the program. It's taxpayer funded. We understand that we need to make sure the program can continue to operate. We want to make sure that they're calculating these things properly. Client sent me a letter, said they owed $300,000. I asked the state for verification. I said, I want you to send me all your documents to show me how you got to this number, $300,000. But what we found is that the state was not giving my client any credit for their share of costs. So they were treating the Medicaid reimbursement rate as the only rate, and they just times that by however many months they were on the program. And they didn't account for the $3,000 a month that my client was paying as their share of cost. And they said, your Medicaid reimbursement rate is not this. You got paid my client's share of cost. You're going to have to reduce that by $3,000 times however many months they were on Medicaid. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You're right about that. We'll get that fixed. That was worth a lot of money. And if the client wouldn't have sent that and we hadn't reviewed that, the state would have been given, you know, lots more money than they were ever entitled to, simply because of a clerical error like that. So it's just important to be careful and be aware of that. So protecting the home from lien and recovery, what can we do? So the practical steps to follow, if we're talking about initiating in terms of when the client goes on Medicaid in a situation where they're needing Medicaid in a crisis situation, which is oftentimes how you may be bringing Kraus into your planning. And so potentially could be to utilize an exempt transfer, because if there's an exempt transfer that allows us to transfer this home to a caregiver child or a disabled child, then that should help us to get away or be able to be free from the estate recovery and lien provisions. We can also ask, do we qualify for an undue hardship? Is there an undue hardship to some sort of protection that we have within our state that would allow us to be free of this? And third, should we engage in some proactive planning? Is that something that's available to us practically? In a crisis plan, probably not. But if we have some time to think about it and your clients are coming in, then that might be something you might be able to think about. So what is an exempt transfer as it relates to the home? As I mentioned before, an exempt transfer is one that does not run afoul of the Medicaid transfer of asset prohibition. So these are statutorily defined, and these are typically undertaken in a crisis situation because they work quick. They're not something we usually want to utilize in a proactive planning situation, because we're always going to have these exempt transfers to utilize when we can. Those transfers can include the transfers to a spouse, transfers to a child under 21, transfers to a permanently disabled adult child, transfers to a sibling with an equity interest, transfers to a child who has been living in the home for at least 2 years prior to institutionalization and has been caring for the applicant. So this caregiver transfer is one that it gets a lot of play, and rightly so, because the public policy decision behind allowing that to happen is that we want to incentivize our people in the community to take care of mom in her home and to just try to keep her off Medicaid for as long as we possibly can. If that means that we can allow the exempt transfer of the home to that caregiver child, then that's what the purpose of the statute is. Same thing with any sort of disabled adult child or someone with an actual equity interest in there. You know, there are some circumstances that it isn't just a regular run-of-the-mill mom was living in the home, mom transitioned to the nursing home, the home was completely free from anybody living there. And that's really where lien and estate recovery provisions can trigger. But these exempt transfers are where you can utilize transfers to benefit and potentially protect yourself from estate recovery. But I always want to mention that we need to be careful about potential collateral consequences to that, meaning non-Medicaid related consequences of such a transfer. So let's assume that we have that caregiver child and they've lived in the home for at least 2 years. And we transfer, and the first step is we're going to transfer mom's $600,000 house with no mortgage. We're going to transfer it to the caregiver child, and the caregiver child is going to then sell the home. Well, we know we're going to have a massive tax liability for doing that. So you have to ask yourself, how long is mom going to live on Medicaid? And is it worth the potential six-figure tax liability that the caregiver child would potentially receive if they were to sell that home in the short term? It may just be beneficial to do nothing. It's okay. If sometimes the best strategy is actually to do nothing. Let's say mom is just in terrible situation, right? And she's going to live just a few months. It would not be good to utilize that caregiver transfer. If we have to pay a month or two of Medicaid estate recovery on that home, and the rest of it's going to be able to be distributed with the basis adjustment of death, that's a much better outcome than transferring it to the caregiver. And so it's not to me saying that these exempt transfers aren't something to be utilized. It's just please look at what the potential collateral consequences would be, including that discontinuation of mom's control over the asset. If mom were to go home or be able to go home, or maybe there's other siblings that are involved. And if you transfer that home to that caregiver child, and then mom passes away and that caregiver child now sells the home and has the ability to receive the funds and from that home proceeds completely, mom's lost the potential to have that eventual distribution to maybe her other kids. So it's something to be aware of when you're using one of these exempt transfers to ensure that one, that's done the right way, it's something that may be Medicaid compliant, may have some negative consequences on the back end. Federal law does require that states determine procedures that ensure that liens and recoveries do not impose an undue hardship upon heirs. Now, I have a statutory citation from Florida here that states something I think should be commonplace, but maybe it's not, stating that a hardship does not exist solely because the recovery will prevent heirs from receiving an anticipated inheritance. That's not going to be enough. And remember that waiver and deferment are not the same thing. So the reward of the waiver saying you're going to get a hardship waiver, that means it goes away forever. Deferment, just as you would imagine, it's deferred to a later time. So don't use those words as synonyms. The award of a hardship, however, is always going to be discretionary on the state. You're going to have to meet certain criteria that are outlined in the state's regulations and rules. And those rules are going to be different. And there isn't a right that you meet that you get it by right. It's typically something in the state that they have said, we threw this at the wall, some of this spaghetti, and here's what we stuck, and this is what we mean by undue hardship. And that can be something different, right? In North Carolina, they have something where they say sole income producing properties and gross income is below 200% of the poverty level. If you do meet that, among other things, then we'll grant you an undue hardship waiver. Now, these aren't the only ones in these states. These are just a selection. But for example, Ohio says if recovery would make the beneficiary eligible for public assistance, then we're not going to recover from that. And so they're saying we don't, this doesn't make any sense if we recover from this and then we have to pay the money out for the person to go back on public assistance anyway. Virginia has a homestead of modest value provision. Washington State has a recovery, if the recovery would deprive an heir of a place to live and they cannot afford other shelter, which is a big deal in a place with high cost of living like Washington State. You might have someone who would deprive one of these heirs of a place to live and they cannot afford any other shelter. So let's assume that, you know, they're living in there and they got it transferred to them through some sort of non-probate transfer. In Washington is an expanded recovery jurisdiction. So you have someone who's now living in this house and there's something that's owed, that beneficiary could potentially qualify for an undue hardship waiver because they couldn't go anywhere else. Similarly, in Rhode Island, the loss of livelihood or necessities, if those endanger life, then the undue hardship waiver could potentially be approved. And then in South Carolina, if that individual is covered by a qualified long-term care insurance partnership, then they could receive an exemption. That's South Carolina saying, hey, if you've done some proactive planning using these long-term care insurance partnership policies, then we're going to give you a benefit for that. We want you to engage in that. It helps save the state money. And if that's the case, we won't recover from the lien or estate recovery. So what are our options in other ways? Well, can we give away the home? No. No, we can't do that. We can't give away the home and maintain Medicaid eligibility. Can we sell the home and spend down the proceeds in a Medicaid-compliant manner? Potentially. And that could be the use of Medicaid-compliant annuity, which with the understanding that the state's going to recover a payback from that as well. We can convey the home and retain a life estate. Be careful with that because states sometimes don't like that idea. They want to make sure that you're not utilizing oftentimes a life estate in a crisis plan without some guidelines and some guide rails. Do nothing and wait. I told you that that might be the best strategy sometimes. Not always and not majorly, but sometimes, particularly if the equity is going to be higher than the eventual lien and if you were to transfer that to somebody, then they may have capital gains. Transferring the home using some sort of ladybird beneficiary or death deed, that's acceptable in some states, maybe, but some states may prohibit that, including transfers to the living trust, which may also be limited in some way by the state. And you can understand why, because if you live in a limited recovery jurisdiction, transferring the home using this beneficiary deed is going to what? It's going to preserve Medicaid eligibility, it's going to preserve the step-up in basis, and it's going to remove the home from probate, thereby avoiding estate recovery. Well, you can understand why a limited jurisdiction would not want you to utilize ladybird beneficiary or death deeds, because they don't want you to preserve Medicaid eligibility and escape estate recovery. They don't want you to be able to do that. Here's Arkansas, which at one point they have a department, here's their statute, says the department may make a claim against the estate of a deceased recipient, and then I have it crossed out, or interest acquired from the deceased recipient by a grantee of a beneficiary. So you can see here, Arkansas, which is a limited recovery jurisdiction, had a statutory change which said, we don't like these beneficiary deeds. They're depriving the state of the ability to recover, and we don't like them. So we're going to actually have something in statute that says that if you do it by that and you receive a benefit from the home and interest acquired use of the beneficiary deed, we can still recover from that. Well, they decided that they didn't like that either. So now they've changed it, they've crossed it out. So it was allowed, then it was disallowed, now it's allowed again. Using trust to protect the home, it may be a good option to avoid estate recovery, but again, be aware that some states aren't going to like that, particularly if they live in a limited recovery jurisdiction. Colorado is a good example of this. They don't allow you to transfer it to a trust because they don't want you to be able to escape estate recovery. And additionally, kind of to bring these two concepts together, imagine if your state imposes a TEFRA lien, such as a transfer would be ineffectual because they're going to be able to put the lien on the home. Whether you have it as yourself or whether you have it in a little revocable trust that you want to try to use probate avoidance, the state's still going to be able to assert that TEFRA lien on the property that you own. But from a conceptual standpoint, If you transfer a home, if you live in a recovery limited jurisdiction, you transfer the home using a death deed or a living trust, then you would theoretically have no recovery. In an expanded estate recovery jurisdiction, if you did that same transfer by death deed or living trust, you would still have a recovery. So in my state, which is an expanded recovery jurisdiction, a transfer to a living trust or utilizing a death deed is not going to be sufficient to allow me to protect against estate recovery. In crisis plan situations, therefore, it's going to be very difficult for you to find solutions that allow you to maintain eligibility for Medicaid and prevent you from getting estate recovery, because those things are designed to buttress each other together. They are collaterally reinforcing, because they want to make sure that if you're in a crisis situation that you can't just give away assets to get on a program that is taxpayer funded. The point is, the state wants to be able to recover that. So Medicaid's transfers of asset rules for eligibility, like I mentioned, were in tandem with expanded estate recovery to keep assets close to the grantor and subject to reimbursement. So the best way to protect the home if you're not in a crisis situation is to engage in proactive planning. The use of certain irrevocable trust instruments like the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust, they can prevent main and estate recovery provisions from attaching not just the home, but to any asset properly conveyed. One of the things when I talk to attorneys and practitioners and people in the Medicaid field throughout the country, is I always try to tell them that just because a trust is irrevocable doesn't mean it's Medicaid compliant. And so a trust can be irrevocable and it still won't meet the criteria for being Medicaid compliant, meaning it will be subject to estate recovery. But the concept behind a MAPT, a Medicaid Asset Protection Trust, is that we're trying to set up a line of demarcation between the grantor and assets transferred to the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust, with the result being assets held within the MAPT are not assets within the recovery estate, thereby providing insulation from lien and recovery, even in expanded recovery jurisdictions. So let's assume Eleanor is asked you to draft the Medicaid Asset Protection Trust. She conveys her home to it and she continually resides in there for 5 years. Her health deteriorates, she's admitted to the facility. Now it's time to go on Medicaid. Now we're known we're beyond the 5 year look back, right? So the transfers that we made to the MAPT are beyond the 5 years and they're not subject to the eligibility review so long as we've drafted the trust properly. Eleanor passes away after receiving Medicaid assistance. The state sends a notice and says, hey, you owe us all this money for Eleanor's Medicaid. And we, through the Eleanor's trustee, will be able to provide a copy of the trust showing it's not subject to estate recovery and the claim would be abandoned. I did this lots and lots of times during my practice, even in an expanded recovery jurisdiction, because the state was not able to recover against an asset in which the client's home was in the MAPT. This is a lien and recovery brochure from Montana, which is also in an expanded recovery jurisdiction. And it outlines, there you see there, lien recovery through this Montana statute. That's the lien, that's the TEFRA lien on that first paper there. And on the second side, that's Montana's estate recovery program. Most states will have some sort of brochure, some sort of manual like this that will be as a pamphlet for informational purposes that can help you if this is something that's new, kind of dip your toes in and see exactly what the state does and how it does in terms of how it governs, whether it has a TEFRA right, how it is if it's a limited or expanded jurisdiction, and under what circumstances would they recover, and when are the state going to allow for deferrals or hardships. So it's a good way for you to take kind of a next step after this presentation. So what does the future of estate recovery hold? And I'm going to tell you it's uncertainty, because there's been some recent case law where states have become a little bit more aggressive in trying to recover against properties that are inside irrevocable trusts like MAPTs. And the idea then is, what is the valuation? So the benefit is always going to be that the valuation for estate recovery purposes is always going to be lower if they consider it to be a life estate than they do a fee simple asset. So transfers to the MAPT are still the best way to do it, but it may be that our future fighting may be on valuation, not necessarily on whether they're able to recover. So in conclusion, the states may assert lifetime liens. These are TEFRA liens if institutionalized Medicaid recipient can't return home. states are required to recover from the estates of deceased Medicaid recipients. And we can take two different jurisdictional approaches depending on what your state's deciding to do. Limited recovery, which is only from the probate estate. Expanded recovery, which is from the probate estate and any assets owned at the time of death. Clients can protect against recovery by utilizing undue hardship if they're eligible for that. An exempt transfer to some sort of protected class, like a spouse or disabled child, if circumstances dictate, with the understanding that those collateral consequences may not be the best. Or conveying, utilizing beneficiary deeds or living trusts in limited jurisdictions with no TEFRA. Best practice, in my mind, is both in limited and expanded jurisdictions, is to engage in proactive planning, utilizing some sort of trust instrument, safeguarding the home from initial and continuing eligibility. So with that, I'm going to stop my screen here and ask, I mean, we're at right at 12 o'clock my time, if there were any questions, and I'll turn it over to my wonderful helpmate who introduced me.
I do have one question. When mom leaves a house to a disabled child that is exempt, but if child is also in Medicaid and cannot reside in the home, what is the solution?
Yeah, so oftentimes we utilize the transfer to disabled children, knowing that it's going to work on one end, right? There's lots of disability programs. So I always tell the clients and attorneys throughout the country, you have to make sure that it meets both the grantor and the grantee. So we know it's going to be okay for mom's Medicaid, right, to transfer that to the child, the disabled child. And we have to make sure that the recipient, disabled child, if they can't live there, that's okay. We just have to make sure that that transfer is okay for their purposes, for their Medicaid purposes. And most of the time it's okay. I did quite a few transfers of the home from mom to the disabled child, who then, you know, even if they're not living there fully, that was okay because for under their Medicaid program, it was an exempt asset. And so at that point, you really just kind of kick the can, but at least you know that you've made a transfer that's not going to be subject to estate recovery. When you have a heavily appreciated asset like a home, again, you have to make sure that you have looked at those tax consequences pretty carefully.
Thank you. That is all the time we have for questions today. If we didn't get to your question, we will follow up with you later this week. Thank you again, Zach, for your great presentation. And thank you to everyone for joining us today and for completing that post-webinar survey. Have a great afternoon, everyone.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining.